This week on Out in the Air features inventor, entrepreneur, writer, actor, singer-songwriter, athlete, and more, Ken Huntley, who will share the span of his story life and document it in his yet-unpublished book, Chasing Fins. Our spotlight's on LaPorte County Symphony's 53rd concert season, with its first concert, Dream of America, on November 8th with Executive Director Emily Ayanas.
Express yourself through art, and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art, and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight for the LaPorte County Symphony. We have her back again to tell us about what's coming up out there, of course, in November, and maybe talk a little bit about what's coming down the road. Emily Ayanas, who is the executive director and also a great vocalist in her own right, and she's going to tell us about, well, first of all, we wanted to bring up about how some of the things you just had, like Hoosier Star and the Drayton concerts, how those went. So, Emily, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here again. Yes.
Yeah, we adore you.
Oh, thank you, Esther. I always love talking with you guys. So we just finished up two big events. Hoosier Star in September 13th. We had the Hoosier Star of Stars. So the nine winners from 2016 to 2024 came back and competed. It was just a fantastic evening of stellar performances. And James Neary, the 2016 winner, was the grand prize winner of the evening, Hoosier Star of Stars. His rendition of Somebody to Love brought the house down. It was incredible. And Julia Thorne was the runner-up with her song from Anastasia the musical. So it was a really wonderful, wonderful event for the symphony.
Right.
Oh, and perfect.
And people who aren't familiar with James Neary, he's with the band Stop, Drop, Rewind. Anyway, tell us also, you have the Drayton concerts, the concert that you have, I think you, what, do two or three concerts in a day and you bustle them in and bring them out? And
Right, yes, three concerts. So that was Wednesday, October the 8th, and almost 5,000 kids came through the LaPorte Civic Auditorium that day for three concerts, 9:30, 11:10, and 12:45. The concerts are about 45 minutes in length. And this year we presented a concert in partnership with Carnegie Hall link-up program called the Orchestra Swings. So we were a partner orchestra with Carnegie Hall, and there are many partner orchestras throughout the country who present these same education programs. They're designed by Carnegie Hall with teacher education materials. Teachers can get professional development credits for teaching in their classrooms, and the kids actually play recorders and sing along with the program, with the orchestra. So it's very participatory, and it was just so great to see all those kids out there enjoying the concert and getting to participate in it as well.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Now we have coming up your first, I guess I'll call it your real concert of the season.
Yes.
And that's going to be on November 8th. So tell us all about that.
Right. Our season opener. So our subscription season opens Saturday, November 8th. We have a wonderful program kicking off the whole season called America the Beautiful, which is a celebration of the 250th birthday of America, of the signing of the Declaration of Independence 250 years ago. And this concert we're calling Dream of America. The central piece is a work by a modern composer by the name of Peter Boyer, and it's called Ellis Island, Dream of America. And it tells the story of immigrants and their contributions to America in the words of these seven actors who portray the immigrants on stage alongside the orchestra and projected images from the Ellis Island archives. So it's a really multimedia, multi-artistic work that we're going to present that's going to tell this amazing story. So we're very excited about that. And then on the other half of the program, we have a John Adams piece called Short Ride in a Fast Machine. And a piece, John Williams, very famous American composer, Escapades, which many people may not be familiar with that name, but they'll recognize the tune as it comes from the soundtrack to the movie Catch Me If You Can with Leonardo DiCaprio. And that features a saxophone soloist who is coming, a young man by the name of Nick May, who is a Kansas City-based saxophonist. He'll be playing the big solo in that, as well as the solo in a brand new piece. We're doing another world premiere by composer Kevin Day. And this is a piece called Upwelling, and it's for solo saxophone and orchestra. And it was orchestrated just recently, and the LCSO will be performing the world premiere of that work.
Oh, so exciting.
Very excited to welcome Nick and to have all of these wonderful American composers represented on this program.
And having a saxophone as a piece with orchestra, that's not usual. That's not a usual combination.
Right. Yeah, you don't usually see the saxophone with the orchestra. So that's going to be a different kind of experience, I think, for our listeners.
And then we'll talk about this, of course, in another interview, but you have Holiday Pops coming up. Maybe just touch a little bit on that.
Oh, sure. December 13th, always a familiar favorite of the LaPorte and LaPorte County community. It's just a wonderful festive program. Carolyn Watson always puts together something wonderful for us with little surprises. This year, I can share a few little tidbits. She's programmed some music from Charlie Brown Christmas, and we'll also have the return of the electric violins with some of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra pieces, and we'll have our special guests Illumination vocal group back singing with us as well. So that'll be a wonderful way to celebrate the holidays and a great thing to bring your whole family to.
Right. It's always a great event to come to. Well, we just have about a minute left, and we want to give you a chance to tell us all about the Dream of America concert, all the details on that, and where they can get tickets and or tables.
So tickets are available online at lcso.net. Some table seats are available. Those are $37, and those can be purchased online. A table of 10 can also be purchased. And then balcony seats are general admission, and those are $26 for adults and $23 for seniors. Children and students with ID are free for all of our four subscription concerts of the season. So they do not need a ticket. They can just show their ID if they're a high school age or college age student, and they get in free. So bring the whole family and come and enjoy Dream of America. We'll also have a few little lobby activities for kids and adults prior to the concert. We've got the Lubesnik Center, who's going to be offering up a craft. And so we're really excited to have some America-themed activities along with the show.
Well, that's Emily Giannis, the executive director for the LaPorte County Symphony, November 8th, Saturday, 7 p.m., Dream of America. Thank you for coming on Art of the Year Spotlight.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be a stellar season.
Thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Peter Marks, former theater critic of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Ken Hundley to Art on the Air. Ken has many accomplishments. He is an inventor, writer, actor, singer-songwriter, and athlete. As a singer-songwriter, he was on The Gong Show and did not get the gong. As an actor, he was part of a limited storyline on the soap opera Santa Barbara, where he acted in and choreographed a fight scene, which was novel at that time. Ken has been designing strength training equipment since 1983, with the machines being sold all over the world. His first patent was on a multifunction gear puller designed for the auto and aerospace industry, called the Complete Puller. His second was for a line of sports emulators. In 1989, he formed the company Specific Athletic Movement Emulator, or SAME. He has had a golf swing, batting, throwing, football, tennis, and soccer emulator. He has finished writing a memoir called Chasing Fins. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Ken. It's nice seeing you again.
Oh, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me here.
Well, like we always start off with our interviews, we usually ask how you got from where you were to where you are now. But that's kind of like going to be the whole show right now, is with your memoir as kind of a guideline, yet unpublished, but it's we have the privilege of actually having a preview of it. But we want to know how you got from where you were to where you are now and all the things that happened in your storied life.
Yeah.
Ready, set, go.
Well, you know what? There's a component of my brain that came with my DNA. I have nothing to do with it. And when Esther told me this was going to be the question, I called it part of my brain Albert, as in Einstein, because it's 10 times smarter than I am. So Albert says, here's what you need to do. You need to find all the common elements of your personality to help explain how all this stuff happened. We're not going to go through all this stuff, but I wanted to start with this. So where I am now, let's start with where I am now. I've got a training facility in Mount Prospect, which is about 20 miles north of Chicago. And in that facility, I have the equipment that Esther was talking about. So I train people in that. So how I got there and how I got into inventing, actually my foray into this had to do with all these personality traits. So let's get through that. The part of my brain that knows this stuff says, okay, this is what you got to talk about. So these are things that are intrinsic in my personality and not things that were developed. I came into this world with this stuff, not really knowing what it was. And so one of the things that I had going for me was I had no fear about anything. I was fearless and sometimes clueless. So I was very curious about everything. And I'm always asking lots of questions. I've been able to travel all over the world easily because I never got attached to stuff. And I'm also kind of the opposite of a hoarder, so I don't collect stuff. So I was born with a skill set that allowed me to do anything, whether I'd ever done it before or not. And I could do it like a professional within just a few hours. Now, that particular skill set did not come out of the closet, so to speak, till I was about 35. There were hints of it in my previous history, but it didn't really happen to me at about 35. And I call that part of my brain Albert, and I have nothing to do with this creation. Now it kind of functions as its own entity.
So Ken, how did it show up in childhood maybe?
Well, in childhood, it kind of poked its head out of the curtain. When I grew up, there were grade schools and high school. There was no middle school. So my eighth grade in high school, I went out. I don't know why, but I heard there was an audition for a play. I auditioned for the play. I got the part. And then later on, I was told, by the way, this is the senior play and you're taking the lead in the part. So evidently the talent there was not very good. So the bar was kind of low. And I got the lead role in the senior play. And a few weeks into rehearsals, the director says, by the way, we're not going to use any props for this. I don't know why, but I turned into a diva and I said, no, I'm out. I'm not doing it. I don't want to embarrass myself. And they came to me, the whole crew and actors and director, they all came to my house to lobby me to do this. And then they said, oh, by the way, this is also going to state. This is a state competition. And I said, I think you guys are nuts. And they finally taught me to doing it. So we did this play. It was called Everyman, ironically, and I feel like I am Everyman. It was a morality play, and we did it for the state. No props. We came in second in the state. So that's the first – had that happened to me in Los Angeles, I would have been a child actor. But because of the environment that I grew up in, there were no kudos for anything that you were doing. No one would ever say, hey, you're good at this. You should do. No, that was frowned upon. No compliments about anybody unless it's your own family. And you only do that in the presence of your own family. So culturally speaking, it was kind of a deprived place. No one ever thought anything about it. Said, oh, yeah, that was good. Next. So that was the first instance of it. Now, the second instance has to do with what Larry had talked about earlier. I started to play guitar on a regular – well, let's back up here. In the senior play in senior high school, in my last year, we did a musical. I had to learn to play the guitar. I'd never played before. I didn't have a guitar. So they said, okay, can you learn to play the guitar in 2 months? I said, okay, sure. So I learned to play the Beatles song Yesterday. And I played it, and I did it well. And I didn't think – nobody thought anything about it. I put the guitar down. I didn't pick it up again for 3 years later. And then when I started to play in more regularly, I asked my brother, I said, give me your old Roberts reel-to-reel tape recorder. So he gives me this recorder. I can only record two tracks on it at a time. Unlike most people, when I started playing guitar, I also started to write immediately. And I think this was Albert, and I didn't even know it. And the songs that I wrote were not three chord progressions. These were complicated songs. I don't have a clue where that came from. But I'm hearing the songs. I'm also hearing all the harmony parts and different guitar parts, different vocal parts. So I take the recorder to a electronic store. I said, hey, guys, I need to turn this into an 8-track recorder. So they just started laughing at me. I said, well, that's not possible. I said, I'll be back. So I went home. I don't know what possessed me to think I could do this, but I just start taking the recorder apart. I recognized that, you know what, the recording and playback heads, they were not soldered into the motherboard. They were plugged in using RCA jacks. And I thought, okay, whatever I'm going to do, this is going to make it easier. I go back to the electronics store. I said, give me all these switches. They gave me 6 switches. I put them together, and I basically was able to record 8 tracks on a 2-track recorder. So I took the recording that I made. I took it back into the electronics store. I said, listen to this. And they said, what is this? I said, well, this is 8 tracks on a 2-track recorder. The guy says, well, it sounds like crap. I said, yeah, it does, but it's 8 tracks of crap.
Excellent.
Those were my first 2 forays into having something out of the ordinary.
And did you, you know, when you, what type of recorder was the bass recorder, the 2-tracker? What kind of?
It was a Roberts reel to reel.
Roberts, okay. Yeah, I know. Because I ran a small 4-track studio, and then, of course, I had a 2-track recorder to master to. So, but I think Esther was going to tee up. Maybe we'll take a listen to one of your first songs at this point, because we talked about you early on. Maybe tell us a little bit about Can't Sit Still, the story behind that, and we'll take a listen to it.
Yeah, so we're going to listen to this first?
No, go ahead and talk about it.
Okay, so I'm in L.A. I wrote this song in San Francisco. My girlfriend was a little antsy. Let me back up here. This is my LA girlfriend. Sorry about that. So she's a little antsy. She was from Amsterdam, and she's a little crazy. And she liked to fight. And that's kind of how I came about this song. I'd rather be playing guitar than fighting with you. And I'm ADD, and I can't sit still. And I want to play my music and get away from you.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll take a listen to that right now. This is Kent Huntley and Can't Sit Still.
As long as I hear that music down the street, see you packing you.
that was Can't Sit Still with our guest today, Ken Huntley, telling us about his whole life and times and how he created a 8-track recorder from a 2-tracker.
So, you know, I have a childhood question again. So were you seeing family members fixing things? Is that, were you exposed to watching watching equipment be made and fixed? I mean, was that sort of part of your experience?
No, my childhood, you know what? Randy and his life kind of took over everybody's lives. Once he signed his contract, Randy was a phenom in high school. He was a freak unto itself. He was a little guy, 5'11", 155 pounds, but he was a supreme athlete in every sport. He got offers to play football, basketball. In those days, you ran the track in 100 yards, not 100 meters. And Randy ran the 100-yard dash in football uniform in 10.4 seconds.
Wow.
So that was fast. When he played baseball, he could hit the ball 400 feet on a line drive, and nobody could figure out why because he was just a little guy. So that kind of dominated the whole – everything we did. Once he signed his contract, our vacations were about going to spring training and staying there for a month. I didn't really – there was really nothing else in my life other than baseball. I mean, I started playing baseball when I was 5 years old. We didn't have – T-ball then. We had real pitchers throwing to each other when they were 5 years old. That's kind of what most of my childhood was about. Also, we lived across the street from a 3,500 land grant farm from the King of England, and I used to spend a lot of time outdoors and away from the house. I love exploring outdoors. So most of my experiences were individually by myself in that situation, but when we went to family stuff, we had a big family. We would go down to my uncle's farm, which my mom grew up on, and this was a tobacco farm, and they grew everything to eat except for salt and sugar. And I asked my mom, I said, well, did you have to buy salt and sugar? She said, sometimes we did not have the money to do it, so we would take chickens to the grocer. He would give us salt and sugar once we traded the chickens in.
Mm-hmm. Barter's great.
It's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, it's been going on for a long time.
So tell us, and I know we'll take you back even a little bit further before we move forward with your story. Tell us about like where you were born, where you grew up, and a little bit about that real early childhood experience.
Okay, so I was born in a little town called Martinsville, Virginia. It's in Southern Virginia, about 10 miles from the North Carolina border. This was an industrial hub in the 60s. American Furniture, Bassett Furniture, DuPont. We had wealthy people and poor people. There wasn't much of a middle class there. There were no unions. So there was no unemployment. I mean, literally, if you wanted a job, there was one there. Kind of a rural environment. We lived right on the border of the city and the county and spent most of our weekends going down into the country and spending time with our relatives. Both of my parents grew up in a kind of a extremely rural environment. They made a movie about my mom's family. It was called Lawless. It's about moonshiners in the 20s. And this moonshine was... that was currency back in those days. Everybody had it. Everybody drank it. It tasted like crap early on. It's gotten sophisticated now. But the movie Lawless was made about these three Bondurant brothers, and my mom's brother married one of Jack Bondurant's daughters. So that's how we were connected to those people. It was a wonderful place to grow up because it had a lot of outdoor stuff, a lot of freedom. I've met people from cities who never seen grass until they put it in a pipe. So I felt very fortunate growing up in a rural Virginia area. Always something to do outdoors. I've spent most of my time outdoors, and my mom would just call me at dinner time. Ken, dinner's ready. Let's go. And I would be a quarter of a mile away.
That's great. By the way, our guest today is Ken Huntley. He's got a brand, there's so many things he does, but got a yet unpublished memoir coming out. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. You're listening to Lard on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. So take it from there, Ken. And I don't know if people knew who you were referring to when you were talking about Randy, but that was the catcher for the Cubs, Randy Huntley. I just so you people understood who that was.
I'm sorry. I'm blanking out here. Yeah, Randy was he was kind of an innovator. When Randy was small, maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old, he started playing baseball. He didn't like this position, so he told my dad, I want to catch. And my dad, during World War II, he was a catcher, and he was a good catcher. He was even offered a major league contract with the Baltimore Orioles in 42. He had to move to Baltimore when the war broke out. They said, Cecil, you got to join the Army or you got to make planes. He says, I'll make planes because I have a baby. And this was Randy. Randy was like 4 months old. Orioles offered him a contract. He says, no, not happening. If I can't take my family on the road, I'm not going to play. So when Randy started playing ball, my dad, the catcher's mitts looked like a big donut. There was no pocket that would hold the ball by itself. And Randy goes into a department store and he sees a new mitt that's got a hinge on it, and he can close the mitt with one hand and not have to use the other hand. And dad says, you're not going to catch like everybody else is. You're going to catch with one hand. So Randy created one-handed catching when he was 7 or 8 years old. And everybody does this now, but that was kind of an unheard of thing then. So I grew up playing ball, and as soon as Randy signed his contract, my dad started sponsoring baseball teams. And every summer I would play ball on these teams, and we were good. We won tournaments. We traveled all over the country. So baseball is kind of like in the DNA, and it was one of the things that you had to do in those days. And Randy, he signed his contract for $110,000 bonus from the Giants, even though the Orioles had offered him $135,000. Now, the guys in our family are not the sharpest pencils in the box. I asked him why he took the 110 instead of the 135,000. He says, hey, I like to scout. That was the only reason. So that was his reason to go with the San Francisco Giants, and then later he got traded to the Cubs. So that's kind of the baseball connection there. And then eventually Randy's son, Todd, signed in 1990. He played for the Mets originally. And Todd used some of my training equipment. In 1996, he used my batting machine, and he broke the record for most home runs ever hit by a catcher in 1 year.
Wow.
And that was a big deal back in those days. And 3 years earlier, I had sold a machine to the Chicago Cubs. The manager bought it in spring training in Arizona. At the end of the year, he comes into my office and says, hey, I want to help you sell this machine. I thought, wow, okay. So how'd you do with it? He said, I get two guys to use the machine. Rick Wilkins went from 7 to 30 home runs, and this new kid named Sosa goes from 8 to 33. And I thought, wow, I'm in. No, that's not how it worked. They fired the manager for buying the machine, and they gave the machine away. Why? Because Sammy was able to renegotiate his contract. He went from making $800,000 to $6 million. The front office does not like those surprises. And the same thing happened when Todd, when he broke his record. The Mets bought the machine. After he broke that record, they gave the machine away. So my equipment, it seems like all of my inventions are disruptive technology. If my thing is successful, it's going to make somebody else lose money.
So tell us about that. You know, that your inventiveness, how that happened. Now, we talked a little bit about creating the 8-track from the 2-track, but you see an issue and tell us how that, Albert in your brain goes to work and how you can do it better, that whole process.
Well, so Albert didn't really come out of the closet. I had a friend who from my hometown lived in Martinsville. I'm living in L.A. I said, Lonnie, I got to take you to L.A. You're a good musician, but you're a big fish in a small pond. Come to L.A. So he drives his truck out. I drive my car, and his truck broke down in my driveway. I said, Lonnie, I think we were putting a quart of oil in his car every hour his last day. I said, we're going to have to rebuild your engine. He looks around and says, we who? I said, well, I'll do it. He said, have you done this before? I said, no, doesn't make any difference. I'll do it. All it costs you is parts. I don't know why, but I was 100% certain I could do this, even though I had no experience at it. So I rebuilt his engine. I enjoyed that so much, I decided I'm going to do this for a living. So I put an ad in the paper, mobile mechanic, have tools, will travel. I had to rent gear pullers to do this. Three of these tools were on the table. Albert peeks out of his closet and says, you need to go back in the tool store and look at all these tools. This should be one tool. So I go back in the automotive store. I said, show me all your pullers. They showed me 12 gear pullers or 12 different pullers. And I said, I'm going to create one puller that replaces all of this stuff. And the guy laughed at me like I was crazy. And you know what? That's what I did. So Albert designed the thing. And I didn't even know what's happening here. He designed it. I had a machinist make up the prototype. I start using it. Took photographs of the old stuff. Took photographs of the new stuff. Go to my patent attorney. I says, okay, I've got these drawings. First of all, I did all the writing for the patent. And then he says, okay, it's time for the drawings. So I took these photographs. He gave them to two different draftsmen. Somehow or another, Albert realized this is not good. This is not going to cut it. So Albert says, go into an art store and get the same tools that these guys are using. So I went into the art store. I got the tools. I did 23 drawings in pencil. I took them back to my patent attorney. I says, hey, this is what I've got. Can you work with this? He says, where did you get this? I says, I did this. Is it okay? He says, no, it's not okay. It's excellent. You're better than my draftsman. You could do this for a living. And when he said that, I went home, and then Albert comes out of the closet. And every day after that, I invented something new. And after a month, I said, stop, Albert, chill out, man. Inventing it is the easy part. If we don't market it, it's absolutely worthless. Please slow down. So it was at about this time, Albert designed a weightlifting strap that I could use for doing squats inside my apartment. I sold that Muscle and Fitness magazine. And then, ironically, I ran into Ernie Banks' son in Los Angeles. I used to babysit for him. So Joey Banks is in L.A. I said, Joey, where are you going? He says, I'm going to an audition for a Kodak commercial. It's a baseball commercial. You're a baseball player. Come on, let's go. So I go to this audition. I get the commercial. I do it. The money starts rolling in. And I thought, whoa, I got to check into this. Now, I'm going to backtrack a few months earlier. My girlfriend was a musician. She was from the East Coast. I didn't know much about her. But she had been on Broadway. She never told me this. She says, hey, we're musicians, but I need to audition for a theatrical agent. I said, okay. So she didn't know anything about me, didn't know I had done any acting at all. And I didn't think about this. So we sit down and read for the agent. He gets a big smile on his face afterwards. He looks at her and says, well, you're lucky. She gets a big smile on her face. And he says, you're lucky to be working with him because he can act. Well, Ken didn't get any loving that night. But after those checks for the commercial came in, I went back to that agent. I said, hey, you know, I've got the chops. I need to take this to the next level. What do I do? He says, go to do a screen test. Took the screen test. They called me up the next day and said, hey, you got an audition tomorrow morning at NBC for a soap opera, Santa Barbara. I got my first gig with Santa Barbara. And the casting director, they would just call me back. They didn't even audition me anymore. I did about five or six shows on that. And Albert has ADD squared. So I'm in my dressing room supposed to be learning my lines, and Albert's already designing exercise equipment that I haven't even made yet. And Mr. Hunt, we're ready for you. I don't even know my lines, but fortunately for soap operas, you can make stuff up, and as long as it fits
sort into of makes thinking, sense.
it's a one-shot thing. And that's kind of how I got into the exercise. I decided I'm not going to do acting. I'm going to rent a space. I'm going to start making exercise equipment. And that's kind of how that took off.
Yeah, I like what you wrote in your book about that acting is so much sitting around, and that just did not deal with Albert very well. He just couldn't deal with that whole thing. It's like, you know, it's like too much sit down time. You want to be doing something.
Well, it is. And when you have ADD, that's a problem. So most actors don't, if they have that, they can funnel it all back into their acting because they're interested in one thing. Well, Albert wants to know everything. So, you know, that consumes up a lot of my space. Every time he looks at something, he wants to create a new invention. And I'll just say, Albert, please relaxed.
Well, do you ever get to relax? I mean, I know I'm reading, you're kind of opposed to that, but like, is there ever maybe a power down moment? I know I'm involved with a lot of different things that I do, but you know, sometimes it is nice to just say, okay, I'm going to back off a little bit.
I don't know. I would say Ken's a tumbleweed.
Well, Esther's right about that. So Albert is my battery. But I have to shut him up every once in a while, just so I can be a normal human being. And when he's not around, I'm kind of a bumbling idiot, to be honest with you. I'm not an unintelligent person, but I do a lot of stupid stuff when Albert's not looking. So in order to shut Albert down, I have to take a couple of hits of a joint. When I smoke that, Albert goes to sleep, and I can finally be like, and you know what? I'll do that. Oh, there's a guitar. So I will play my guitar for an hour every night. And I'm very fortunate that when I was in LA, I recorded with a bunch of guys who were, you know, would go on the road with recording acts. These were not session guys, even though I recorded with these guys, but I was very fortunate. The bass player on that song that you played earlier, he used to be Etta James' bass player. He also played with Steppenwolf. And,
Well, you know, that time period, you were bumping into so many people. I mean, you wind up in Stevie Nicks' house. I mean, it's just like you go from one interesting person to the next.
Well, you know what? And that's, again, that's all about my skill set. I'm a very easy person to get to know, even if you don't know me. I mean, I could go to any bar in L.A. There'll be an actor in there. I'll go right to the guy and sit down and have a two-hour conversation with him. And he'll never even ask my name. So because Albert is so interested in everything, I've got a huge library of information. I can talk to anybody, whether they're an actor, whether they're a rocket scientist, doesn't make any difference. Everybody's comfortable with me instantly. And I'll be honest with you, a lot of these actors don't have somebody to talk to. And having somebody like me in there that they think is not in the – well, they know I've been in the business because we're speaking some of the same language, and I'll ask them – I've had conversations with actors that are walking down the street on the opposite side of the street, and I'll say, hey, what happened? How'd this get – and we'll have a five-minute conversation and never even introduce ourselves. So if you're in L.A., you're going to see these people. They're not hiding. They're everywhere, and – They gravitate towards people who are not asking them for anything. I see Stephen Colbert ask a lot of his people on his show, have you ever asked for an autograph? I have never asked for an autograph. Albert doesn't think anybody is smarter than he is.
I agree with you about the autograph thing because, I'm a voting member for the Grammy Awards and met a lot of people as a result of that. But I just am interested in talking to them. Autographs are about... like proof that I met a person. If you don't believe me, I don't care. I met them. I got the experience of it and everything.
Yeah. So you've had similar experiences with actors and entertainers. As long as you're not going that route, they'll talk to you all day long.
Right.
All right. Well, Ken, I want to ask about Don't Even Know How Old I Am, that song. I'm interested in what time period you wrote that in, because like when I listened to it, I thought, oh, this has got a little Jimmy Buffett influence, you know, well, your neighbor.
Yeah. So Buffett was in the early 70s and I lived in Key West. He was my neighbor. But this was actually in Los Angeles. I came home hammered one night. I don't have a good memory to start off with. And I don't know if I'm drunk or I don't remember. And I'm trying to think, how old are you? I was so high, I could not remember how old I was. And then during the day, I had walked down the street and I see this indigent guy and he's in this old beat up car. And he's just acting like I don't care what anybody thinks. And I just started... When I wrote the line, don't even know how old I am, I thought about him. So the song was basically about a guy who's living in his car. He can't get anything going. And that's his life, and he's okay with it. So it wasn't so much about me as it was about him.
Well, let's take a listen to that. That's Don't Even Know How Old I Am, with our guest today, Ken Huntley.
Don't even how old I am. Never been to Vietnam. Ain't got no money in the bank. My mind is always going blank. Can't get a date with the working girl. Never been around the world.
And that was Don't Even Know How Old I Am from our guest today, Ken Huntley, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
I still do hear a little Jimmy Buffett in there, but I do think that we do, you know, we're just such a product of everybody we know and have been exposed to.
I totally agree with you. Yeah, you take, if you're lucky, I could, you know, everybody that I meet, I want something from them. And they fill me up with stuff. Albert can't get enough of new people. He loves meeting new people in every aspect of life, in every social context, business, non-business, ditch diggers, politicians, doesn't make any difference. He wants something from them. And you know what? Usually he can bring something to the table also that they don't have. So that's why people like having conversations with me, we both get something out of it instead of just nonchalantly exchanging hellos and kind of stuff like that. I'm a sponge. I ask people what they do. I ask them how they do it. And that's usually Albert wanting to know, how do I do this? Because I'm going to use this later.
Excellent. Is there any new inventions on the horizon? Is there anything that Albert's looking for that said, gee, you know, how can I do what better?
Yes. So the last patent I got was on a thing called a pallet train. I was in a warehouse somewhere in the South, and I'm watching them unload a tractor trailer that's got a bunch of freight in it. Albert looks at that and says, I know how to empty this trailer that's full of freight in 60 seconds. And I thought, please tell me more. So Albert says, okay, we're not going to use pallets. We're going to use something like furniture dollies. They got wheels on them. They got casters on the bottom of them. And they're all about, there's going to be a metal bar underneath the platform, and it's connected to other platforms in front and behind. So when you open the tractor trailer door, you're going to have two rows of platforms. You pull the front one out, and 12 other platforms come out with it. And that way you don't even have to go inside the tractor trailer. So for someone like Walmart, this would save them probably $10 million a week in labor from not having to handle that freight with a human being.
Have you had anyone, you know, take away an idea that you sort of had and you know, slipped out, and then someone else developed it?
Oh, better than that. In the early, I would say in San Francisco, I was taking a shower and I realized, you know what, there's too many bottles in here. I'm going to create this was one of my first inventions too. And I forgot about this. So it was called a washing machine. It was basically a liquid dispenser for your shampoo, your hair conditioner, your soap, and you could stick it up in the shower and it just pushed button dispensing. So I developed this thing. I took it to a company that was supposed to help develop this stuff. They stole it and gave it to somebody else. And I came home one day, and my roommate, who was working for Graham Nash and David Crosby, said, hey, you must be rich now. I said, why? He said, well, I just saw your invention on TV. So I looked at the ad, and sure enough, a company from L.A., had marketed it, changed the design a little bit. And the people I took to develop it, I said, I want to get a patent on this. Oh, no, you don't need a patent. Well, if you don't get a patent, it's going to be easier to get it manufactured. So they took $1,000 of my money, go to an attorney. He says, Ken, don't go after these guys. There's a whole line of people going up. They're going to be closed down by the government for fraud. You've lost your money. So, yeah, that was something that somebody took and ran with. And I didn't get anything for.
Oh, my gosh. Anything else besides that you have coming up on as far as inventions?
I can't. Well, you know what? I try not to do that anymore. I just got my plate so full of the train equipment, number one. Were you thinking of something specifically that you read in the book?
No. I was just thinking in general. So
because oh, no. God, no. You know what? I try to not do that. Focus is not something that's easy for me to do. Now, if Albert says, okay, we're going to work on this, I love that. I love to sit down not knowing what I'm going to do. I'll sit and look at something for a few minutes, and Albert says, okay, here's how we do this. And then here are six other ways to do the same thing.
Right.
So he's, you know what? I think we've all got a little bit of Albert in us. I've been very fortunate that my Albert came out of the closet. I think that most people in this country don't know what they're good at because they've never taken more than a few minutes to decide what am I going to do with the rest of my life. And I think that we don't know what we're doing. I think we're all born with some DNA that literally takes over your life and it's controlling you and you don't even know it. Now, the DNA I'm talking about is called non-coding DNA. The DNA that makes up your body, that's 2% of your DNA. The non-coding DNA, from my perspective, the non-coding DNA is where all your personality traits are. There's also a lot of stuff in there that you can't edit that like you would regular DNA. Non-coding DNA can be edited with a system called CRISPR-Cas9 that was developed by a couple of women. And I believe that eventually you're going to be able to take someone who's addicted to drugs and addicted to alcohol and get rid of that. They've already been successful at getting rid of a few diseases just from editing it. And this editing is done on a computer just like you would cut and paste in Windows. So that to me is really exciting. I think that's going to open up a whole new frontier on the frontier of healthcare. If we could eliminate alcoholism and drug addiction for people in this country, it would change what we have the ability to do with humans' lives.
That is true. I also, you know, and this might not be something that you can actually answer, but with everything that you've done, Ken, and even some of the things that you didn't even know were going on in the background with your family and different offers you had for baseball, looking back on all of it, is there a particular area that you think you would have been happy and satisfied in pursuing as you were talking about these other personalities that can stick with one thing and see it through?
I don't think so, Esther. I don't think Albert is content with going down one road. And that's just the way I'm wired. Now, most people, I envy people that get into one thing and they love it and they discovered it early on and they do it all their lives and they have a great, I never had that. So we're not all wired the same way. But we have to look for what we're good at, because most of us never actually spend any time do that. When I grew up, if you got married and had babies, you had to start looking for work immediately. You didn't have time to look for what you might be better at.
Right.
So Albert's not content with that. I would have loved to have the personality where, hey, I can do this one thing all my life and I'm going to be happy. Nope. He needs more. I have to feed him. He's kind of like that plant in Little House of Whatever, we're in feed me.
Oh, well, yeah, Seymour.
I think several of the things are so complimentary that you did, like, in the book, and I don't know if this is a great big reveal or whatever, but you were offered contracts to play baseball that you did not know about. And so if you had done that or knew about that, I wonder if then the machines would have taken place.
Machines never would have been invented. And here's the deal. Just because – now, that was a contract for college, not for pro ball.
That was college?
Yeah. So – having the physical ability is not the most important part. Having the mentality to do this is everything. That's what separates the pro from the amateurs. Randy was consumed by baseball. He slept with his bat and glove. Every minute of the day, he was thinking about it. And the guys who end up in the major leagues, they are very similar. Because they had ADD as a child and they put all their energy into playing baseball, it made them better than kids who did not have ADD. I had ADD, but it wasn't selective. It was just the opposite. Instead of wanting to do one thing, Albert wants to do everything.
Well, we only have about a minute left. I'm going to give you a chance to talk about your unpublished book, Chasing Fins. Tell us real briefly about what the title means without giving away too much and when you think it might be available.
Well, COVID came around and I needed something to do. I've been thinking, okay, you've done a lot of stuff, dude. Your memory's not good. You need to start writing this down. So I started to write it down, just my experiences from the time I was young all the way up. And people at the same time, I would tell them stories about, you need to write a book. I heard this a lot. So I got about 300 pages of this, of just information, and finally said, oh, I need to do this. So what is this about? What are you doing here? What have you been doing your whole life? And I realized I've been chasing endorphins. Everybody on the planet, their drive is to get endorphins from doing something. So we're all, Fins is a nickname for endorphins. We're all chasing endorphins. We're all trying to find where we get the most endorphins from. If you're fortunate, some people had to settle. I'm not one of those to settle. I get them from everywhere. And you know what? I think that's what drives everybody to do everything that we're doing.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art of the Air and sharing your phenomenal life journey. And we probably talk a lot more, but Chasing Fins will be out sometime, and I'm sure people can find it. Our guest today is Ken Huntley, and he's brought a wonderful background story to us. I'm born in Southern Virginia, and has storied life. Ken, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your journey.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Esther.
Oh, thank you so much, Ken.
Hello, I'm Larry Breckner, board chair for Lakeshore Public Media and also a sustaining supporter. As Northwest Indiana's public broadcaster on TV, radio, and digital, we're not only bringing you the best of PBS and NPR, but more importantly, serve as a vital community resource for great local programs like Regionally Speaking, Eye in the Arts, Friends and Neighbors, Let's Eat with Chef Nick, Art in the Air, Building Blocks, and more. Please help protect my Lakeshore Public Media with your support by visiting lakeshorepublicmedia.org/give. We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.